This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, May 2nd. We'll be discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Gilda Geist. We'll check in with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Paul Benson at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. We'll hear from our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, and we'll speak with Devin Ankeny of the Falmouth Enterprise. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. This month, local elections are taking place in every Cape Cod community except Barnstable, and all of those communities will consider a ballot question about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Also in the news this week, a brush fire got out of control on Joint Base Cape Cod, requiring a response from more than a dozen fire departments. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is joining us with those stories and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
First, let's talk about this ballot question on the nuclear power plant. It's non-binding, but it's intended to send a message. What exactly would it do?
Well, the goal of the community activists who petitioned to get this question on the ballot is to stop the evaporation into the outdoor air in the community of the many hundreds of thousands of gallons of wastewater that remain inside the Pilgrim nuclear plant, which is no longer operating, no longer generating power. Remember, this water contains radioactive material, it contains other contaminants, and at least small amounts. There is a big debate over how filtered or how treated the water is or is not. But it is true that not everything can be removed from that water. So the ballot question itself is non-binding, as you said, but it directs the town government in each town where it passes to itself then call upon the governor, the attorney general, and the legislature publicly to stop the owner of the Pilgrim plant, which is Holtec, from allowing that evaporation to take place.
Briefly, remind us of some of the context here. The state has already denied permission for Holtec, the plant owner, to discharge this water into Cape Cod Bay.
Right. So the state has denied that permit about a liquid release. Holtec appealed the decision. That appeal is ongoing. But in the meantime, this water is becoming airborne through evaporation. One supporter of this ballot question told me that she feels like people in the wider community may not really be fully aware that this evaporation is happening, especially if they heard that the state said no to the water release, then they may think the issue is over. But for people who are very concerned about this, it is far from over.
Now, supporters had to petition to get this question on the ballot in each town. What did they have to say about the rationale here for the ballot question?
Yes. Well, I talked with Joanne Wilson Keenan about this. She lives in East Dennis, and she led the petition drive to get it on the ballot in Dennis. One thing that she emphasized here from the wording of the question itself is the Ocean Sanctuaries Act that prohibits new industrial discharge of contamination into an ocean sanctuary. Cape Cod Bay is an ocean sanctuary. And this is the law that the state used in its denial of the liquid discharge. So the supporters of the ballot question are hoping and arguing that the same law should apply to air emissions over the bay.
Holtec, the company that owns the plant, it disputes the premise behind the ballot question and the wording of it. You've reported on this. Can you tell us a little bit about what they're saying?
Sure, yes. The one thing to mention, the ballot question wording in most towns is pretty much identical. Eastham has put a much shorter version on their ballot, which kind of cuts to the end with cuts to the request to their town government and the state to take action, and leaves out some of this disputed information, which is the ballot question lays out various assertions of fact at the beginning, and Holtec naturally objects to those. One is this alleged violation of the Ocean Sanctuaries Act. Another is that claim that the water evaporating from Pilgrim is untreated. Holtec says the water is filtered and that the state has already determined that for air emission purposes that Pilgrim is within the law. So What exactly is adequate filtration, and what the definition of filtration means sometimes is under debate here. But that is some of that disputed information that got included. Those assertions of fact got included in the ballot question in most communities. This question is also, by the way, on the ballot off Cape in Plymouth and Scituate, and Duxbury voted for something similar at their town meeting.
Okay, let's talk about this brush fire. A brush fire, it's burning even now at Joint Base Cape Cod after a prescribed burn exceeded the intended boundaries of the fire yesterday afternoon. We have kind of limited information about this. In fact, when I say it's burning even now, I'm not entirely sure that's still the case after all the rain that came down. But smoke could be seen throughout the surrounding area yesterday. What do we know about what the status is right now?
You're right that there is not really one major centralized flow of information. We're getting it from police and fire departments and a little from the National Guard. So the National Guard says the fire is contained. All active fire flames have been knocked down. Bourne Police also is saying that the fire is under control, and that personnel working there are being reduced. National Guard says that 50 acres burned yesterday, and that 133 was the area of the prescribed burn. So we got out of control there, burned some additional acres. One police department or fire department source I saw said that it had jumped a road that was really not intended, but it stayed within the confines of the base.
You dropped out just for a second. There was 150 acres have burned, and the intended prescribed burn was 133. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
We know many fire departments from the Cape and off Cape responded to this. What have you learned about the response?
Well, from what I'm seeing, it's likely that about 15 departments have responded in some form. Many from the upper and mid Cape. Some have shared online photos and videos of what they've been working on. Some of those towns include Sandwich, Bourne, Harwich. And then off Cape, because of the Plymouth County Task Force regarding forest fires, there were many towns from off Cape responding as well. Carver, Lakeville, Duxbury, even as far away as Norwell. So yeah, there were many fire departments on the scene. They were doing water drops, and they were talking about how far the smoke was going. The Hanson Fire Department actually said last night that a larger number of acres had burned, but that's not consistent with what the guard said.
Okay, let's shift gears to transportation news. A draft of Cape Cod's 5-year capital plan to improve transportation infrastructure is ready for public comment. Tell us about this. What is this exactly?
Sure. So this document is called the Transportation Improvement Program, sometimes known as the TIP, and it's not really a traditional planning document. It's a 5-year capital plan. It gets updated every year, and it kind of functions as a priority list for what state and local officials have agreed to do with federal transportation dollars over those 5 years. So this plan, of course, has the Cape Cod bridges mentioned, but there are many other projects there as well. Things like reconstruction work on Route 28 in Chatham, Dennis, Harwich, and Yarmouth. There is an installation of a median on the Bourne Scenic Highway. There's Route 6 resurfacing in Barnstable, and some additional funding that's needed to continue the work on the Route 151 corridor in Mashpee.
I know that you talked to the transportation program manager at the Cape Cod Commission for this story. What were some of the highlights that she had as she looked at these plans?
Well, one that she said is really going to be particularly transformative is in Provincetown. There, they are removing some lanes on Route 6. It's 2 lanes in each direction. She says they're not needed, and it's going to be now 1 lane in each direction for part of Route 6. And that extra space will be used for cyclists and pedestrians. There will be a roundabout built where Route 6 meets Schenck Painter Road, which is kind of like that main left off 6 that heads into downtown Provincetown. And of course, people in Provincetown know very well that there is a plan to fully reconstruct Schenck Painter Road and make it much more sort of pedestrian friendly.
who's the final sign off on this? What's the final authority on how this plan comes together?
Well, there is a body, there's a voting body called the Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is really is like a big board composed of state and local and a couple federal officials who make those decisions. And then because they kind of only come together for this purpose, the people who function as their transportation staff actually are the staff of the Cape Cod Commission. So they work very, very closely together.
And briefly, what's the timeline for this? The public comment period is still underway, right? People can see the plan and put in their suggestions or feelings.
Yes. So if you have access to the plan online, which is through the Cape Cod Metropolitan Planning Organization or just the Cape Cod Commission, you can comment in writing by mail or email, which is due. That's due May 12th. And then they are planning on getting some more live comments one more time at a public meeting on May 19th. That's actually in the middle of the day, though. It's at 1 p.m. And then they are likely to vote that day.
And we've got a link to that for people to get there quick and easy by going to our website on capeandislands.org. Jeanette Barnes, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Woods Hole employees of the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration will now be responsible for cleaning their own building in the village after a lapse in the janitorial contract there. It's part of a bigger question of what's going on at NOAA. CAI's Eve Zukoff has been reporting on the latest challenges to the agency's local office. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
This fits into a number of cuts by the Trump administration that are impacting local fisheries staff. Give us the picture here.
Yeah, sure. So I'll pull from E&E News for a moment here to give you some numbers. First of all, they reported that about 1,000 NOAA employees exited NOAA this week on May 1st after accepting early retirement and buyout offers. That's according to current and former employees. And that 1,000 raises the number of total staff reductions since February to more than 2,200 employees. That's about 20% of NOAA that has left in one way or another since the Trump administration took office. But these firings have impacted some departments more than others. They're arguably random, depending on where probationary employees, these like early in their career employees, are coming from. So locally, we're actually hearing that the numbers are even higher. No one wants to talk on record. We've seen an email that we're working on confirming the details on, but it seems like our local offices have taken quite a big hit in the last couple months.
So NOAA, as a federal agency, includes things like the National Weather Service. Here on the Cape, we're talking about the Fisheries Service particularly, and in Woods Hole, where a lot of those scientists are based. Tell us more about this change that we learned about at the Woods Hole office building.
Sure. So the staff at the Woods Hole office building, which is largely made up of scientists and economists, people like that, will now be responsible for cleaning around the building after a lapse in the janitorial contract. So in an email shared with us here at CAI, a NOAA official announced that staffers will be expected to empty their trash and recycling, clean the lunchroom, and designated individuals will now clean the restrooms at the end of each day. They're also expected to manage some security concerns. Gate closures and windows will no longer be handled by maintenance. Again, this is all part of the Trump administration's efforts to cut down on federal spending. And I will say we know this is all also affecting the Woods Hole Aquarium now. They can't offer public access somewhere that won't have clean bathrooms. And this is the oldest public aquarium that's still operating in the U.S., started in 1875.
A lot of questions, and we will be following that. Let's talk about another story you covered this week. 75 North Atlantic right whales have been swimming through local shipping lanes. This is a concern for folks. Explain that.
Sure. So first of all, getting ship strikes is what they're called, boat collisions. That is basically the leading cause of death for right whales. The other one is entanglement in rope and fishing gear, but they kind of each edge each other for the top spot every year. And 75 right whales may not sound like a lot, but it's a little less than a quarter of all the right whales left in the world. Now, researchers have observed groups of feeding right and sei whales actually in the springtime in this area of the shipping lanes over the last few years. But this year's aggregation is one of the largest researchers have ever seen in that area. So Federal officials have established a slow zone for boats in the shipping lanes, but the feds can only urge mariners to reduce speeds to 10 knots. It's a completely voluntary practice, which is why the concern is so great for right whale scientists and advocates.
And again, ship strikes, one of the major causes of death for these animals. Among these right whales that were seen was a particular whale, a whale named Calvin. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Calvin is this whale who in 1992 was orphaned at just 8 months old, which is too young for a right whale to be alone, typically, after her mother was killed by a boat. And since then, she has endured entanglements and giving birth to 4 calves of her own. But then 3 years ago was the last time she was seen. People were starting to get really worried that this whale that had become a symbol of endurance, who inspired this group called the Calvineers, a youth right whale advocacy group based up in Maine, that perhaps she was gone. And she was seen here in Cape Cod waters almost 3 years since her last sighting in the last few weeks. She did have she actually looked quite good, healthy. And again, people had given up hope that she was still alive after not being seen for so long.
That's CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
The AmeriCorps Cape Cod program has potentially lost its funding as part of a massive federal cutback. Supporters say its work makes positive impacts all across the Cape. Now that Barnstable County government may be stepping in to help, CAI's Gilda Geist has details. Hi, Gilda.
Hi, Steve.
For anyone who's not familiar with AmeriCorps and the Cape Cod program, sketch out some of what it does. It's had a hand in a lot of environmental work here on the Cape.
Yeah, so AmeriCorps Cape Cod is an 11-month residential program. It's funded half by the county and half by the federal government. And yeah, members provide a range of services on the Cape, including environmental work. So that's stuff like invasive species removal, like setting up erosion controls, clear out herring runs. They help IFAW with marine mammal strandings. They help the state with prescribed burns, all that kind of stuff. But they also do work in some other areas, including natural disaster preparedness and response, youth education, and public health outreach.
So the federal cutbacks to the national AmeriCorps program mean that this local program could go away altogether, or the funding for it. That's now being fought in court at the federal level. Meanwhile, local supporters attended an emergency meeting this week about the local Cape Cod program.
Yeah, so this was apparently, they're saying, the county is saying, one of the most well-attended Barnstable County Commissioners meetings in recent history. Over 100 people showed up to the virtual meeting to just talk about the situation and figure out how they're going to move forward. And that was yesterday morning.
A lot of impassioned support for this program, it seems like, from the turnout.
Yeah, one comment that stood out to me was from Chip Riley, who's the Emergency Preparedness Director for Cape Cod. And he was saying that back in 2023, when Hurricane Lee was happening, he was like on his way to work listening to updates about the hurricane. And he ended up hearing that it switched course and was headed toward us. And so AmeriCorps Cape Cod members are the people who would be tapped to help out in the event of an emergency like a hurricane, specifically by staffing regional shelters. They may do other stuff as well. But so that AmeriCorps cohort had just started that week, so they weren't trained yet. So Chip said he called up Cape Cod AmeriCorps program manager and asked if he could do a last minute training with the members. And by the end of that day, they were ready to deploy. Luckily, they didn't end up needing to use that training that day, but that's the kind of thing that AmeriCorps members would be doing if there was an emergency.
It looks like the Barnstable County commissioners are coming up with some interim funding to keep this going, at least for a little while.
Yeah, so this year was actually kind of a smaller cohort of AmeriCorps members for Cape Cod, so there was some money left over from the county. So the commissioners voted to use it to fund the program until it wraps up for the year, which is in August. The current members have been going for 7 months, and they have few months left. As for the long term, it's something like 24 states, including Massachusetts, suing the Trump administration in hopes of restoring these programs. But if that doesn't work, the county is prepared to look into transitioning the program into one that is run and funded completely by the county. But in the meantime, the county is encouraging people to call their local representatives and let them know how important AmeriCorps is to them and basically ask for the funding to be restored.
That is CAI's Gilda Geist. Gilda, thanks.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We'll take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak to Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with the reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Last week, an immigrant from Ecuador working on a home in Edgartown fell to his death. It is the second time this year that someone from Ecuador has died after falling at a construction site in the town. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with more details. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us, what do we know about this particular incident?
Yeah, so I guess just a little about who he is. Jorge Riera, 33, was living in Fall River, and as you said, originally from Ecuador. We don't know a ton about him other than he immigrated to the States to help his family financially back home. But right, this is the third from Ecuador actually living in Fall River that has died this year at a construction site. And as you said, the second in Edgartown, which is really shocking. And our story, our headline, there's a lot of questions. Why in particular these folks from Ecuador? Is there a coincidence there? Is there something larger going on? Can we do more to protect them? And what we do know, Tuesday last week, Riera fell basically to his death, 20 to 30 feet up. He was on scaffolding at the time. He was working for a contractor that seemed to own the house. And we know that OSHA, a federal group, is investigating. We also know that the DA has said that there's nothing criminal here. So it seems to be a workplace accident. It's really the same thing that seemed to have happened in February when a construction worker from Ecuador fell from a big project also in Edgartown. And while there's still a lot of questions into this case, we know that the man died in February. The contractor that hired him is facing some heavy fines from OSHA. Their name is Empire Builders. They have so far been fined, I think, $20,000 about. OSHA's investigation is ongoing in that case, so they can't, you know, we don't know all the details, but we do know they could face additional fines, but they've been quiet about it so far. But to me, and we're still looking into this, but one of the biggest questions is, you know, who is responsible here? Is this strictly federal, or does the town have some oversight on these projects?
Your article also points out that deaths by fall are the most common workplace accident deaths in our area.
Yeah, there's this group, labor activist group, released an annual report looking into workplace safety. And I guess what the number one worker death was from 24 was slips and falls. Officials there, you know, couldn't speak to us directly about this case. It's still under investigation. We don't know, have all the details, but they are calling for, you know, better safety measures really across the state. You know, I think it's too premature to point fingers, but we spoke with town building and management officials, and they say this is really up to federal OSHA to enforce these standards, safety standards. On the island, OSHA, you know, doesn't have a presence really at all. That is what local officials told us. And when we ask, you know, can they do something that doesn't look right, what they can do is contact OSHA. But it's not like they have an office here. So it raises some questions in light of two people dying. You know, we asked, is there a potential to hire a local staff person that can investigate, you know, safety issues? And this response was kind of complicated, and really, no, you got to follow these federal regulations. So again, we're continuing our reporting on this. We're actually sending someone to Fall River to get a better sense of what lives these individuals are living. We know they're traveling from the south coast of the Vineyard, which is no easy trip. And does that lead to issues? A lot of questions to look into, and we're just kind of scratching the surface. But this is another, you know, unfortunate tragedy.
That is Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can read more about all of this. Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Harwich is now looking for a new town manager. This comes after an announcement on Monday that the town will part ways with Joseph Powers, its current town manager, at the end of June. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has more details, some more details. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
In truth, I guess there's not a lot of details publicly available. Neither side is saying much about this split, it seems.
No, this announcement came from the select board after their meeting, during their meeting Monday. basically that they had reached a mutual agreement with Joe Powers not to renew his contract. Now, he had a 1-year extension on his contract that was scheduled to expire June 30th, and that is the day they agreed that would be his last as Harwich's town administrator. You know, Joe Powers has had somewhat of a difficult tenure as town administrator in Harwich. He's had difficulty in retaining staff, especially top staff in finance and other town departments. And he's, you know, barely survived a couple votes in the past to maintain his position in the town. And it was pretty clear that something was going to happen based on the previous discussions that have been had by the select board. The board at this point is saying that there will be no further statements from either the board or Powers, and that they will begin making plans to hire or search for a new town administrator after town meeting, which comes up next week.
I want to talk to you about town meeting, actually. Both Harwich and Brewster have town meetings coming up Monday. Can you just point to a couple of the key issues you're watching there as these town meetings get underway?
Sure. In Harwich's town meeting, as you said, starts Monday. It's a 57-article warrant. There's not a ton of really controversial items on the warrant. The most controversial are a number of petition articles. There are a total of 9 petition articles on this warrant, including fertilizer and pesticide prohibitions. Both of those went before town meeting last year and were shot down. The petitioner here, Patrick Otten, is hoping that he can persuade folks that these prohibitions are beneficial to the local environment, so voters will act on that. There's also some discussion about a sewer extension in the Great Sand Lakes area of town. Local residents submitted their own article to sort of accelerate the sewer development in their neighborhood. And the selectmen submitted a competing article. Both of those have split endorsements between the Board of Selectmen and the Finance Committee, so we're going to have to see where those come out. Brewster is going to be launching their town meeting also on Monday, and that's going to happen at the Stony Brook School. Brewster has only 21 articles on its annual town meeting warrant. And again, a lot of the controversy is going to come with some petition articles, including one regarding a wastewater study and another petition to purchase clickers to allow electronic voting at town meeting. That's likely to get some discussion. A lot of towns around here have done that. Brewster is one of the last to adopt it, so we'll see where that goes. So there'll be those two town meetings Monday, and we'll be reporting on the results in our edition next week.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
The Cape's summer economy relies on foreign workers, many who come here to work under what's called the H-2B visa program. The question of how many H-2B visas are available for local businesses is fraught almost every year. But this year, it has been even more stressful for businesses who depend on these workers. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with the story. Hiya, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
You report that for 3 weeks in March this year, the federal government essentially went silent on the status of H-2B visas. Explain how this process maybe is supposed to work.
Sure. Just to step back from it, I mean, it's really important to the economy of the Outer and Lower Cape. There's about 1,700 H-2B visa workers that came last year, just in the 8 towns on the Outer and Lower Cape, so that averages out to about 200 per town. Most of those people come from Jamaica. Most of them come every single year, work for the same employer, you know, sometimes for a decade, sometimes for 2. Oftentimes, you know, they pass these jobs off to their nieces and nephews and kids. So it's a really long-running and pretty stable part of the economy out here on the Outer Cape, and also for the people in Jamaicans who the people in Jamaica who participate.
I think it's when you say long running since 1952, this is a program that has been in place for decades and decades. It would seem not a great thing if it's such a political issue that each year businesses aren't sure if they're going to get their returning workers back or not. And then this year, there was even more concern about whether that could happen.
Yes. So the lottery that happens every January 4th always introduces a lot of uncertainty. Some year, an employer, like a whole batch of employees, will get either an A, a B, C, D, or E, or F or G. And if you get an F or G, you just know those folks aren't going to make it this year. You better find something else. If you pull an A or a B, you know you're going to be fully staffed by the time you open your doors. So it is a lot of uncertainty. And every year, you know, the people who pull in the middle are scrambling through the month of May, waiting for people to arrive in June. And it's just part of life out here. This year, as you said, it got really weird around March 5th when the first batch was all assigned out and the Department of Homeland Security makes this step of announcing the cap is hit and releasing the next batch, and they just didn't announce it for weeks.
So these businesses are like on tenterhooks here waiting to find out if they're going to have employees for the summer, and they can't even find out if there are going to be another batch of H-2B visas issued in order to get those workers back here. Is that's what you're saying?
It was, and, you know, that announcing the cap has been hit, that's like a procedural step. It's not like a decision. It's just an announcement of a fact. Hey, this cap was hit. So the fact that it wasn't done for weeks raised the possibility that it just wouldn't be done, that the department could, you know, withhold announcing that a thing had happened, and by doing so, not release the next batch of visas that they'd already said in December that they would do. So it definitely left people wondering if any of the second batch were ever going to come. And that was the nature of the anxiety through the month of March for people who run businesses out here.
And let's kind of get to the particulars. You talked to a couple of business owners about what this meant for them and what this could continue to mean. Tell us some anecdotal side of this.
Sure. I mean, so Patrick, his family owns Marine Specialties on Commercial Street in Provincetown. And, you know, many of these workers are people his mother hired, you know, 20, 25 years ago. They came to his mother's funeral when she died about 3 Octobers ago, hang in church. There was a year in 2019 where he couldn't find housing. So all of his HGB workers moved in with his parents and all lived in one big 4-bedroom house. So they're very long-term relationships, even though it's designed as a temporary worker program. But because you can come year after year, many Outer Cape employers work with the same people for decades. So it just, the prospect of trying to run your kitchen without your main chefs, or trying to run a kitchen without a dishwasher, or trying to run a hotel without housekeepers, it's not possible. You have to dramatically downsize how many tables are in your restaurant or how many hotel rooms you have on offer in order to make do with a smaller staff. So, and then other jobs are supported by those jobs. So your whole front of the house people in the restaurant can't work if, you know, your prep cook and your dishwasher are missing.
You also speak about how some of the workers who have been returning year after year, decade after decade, they've kind of passed the jobs along within the family. So this is really a long-established family relationship with the local businesses.
Yeah, and, you know, some of the specialists in these visas say that's actually they don't go as far as faulting the Outer Cape, but they say it's not, you know, you're putting yourself at risk by being extremely dependent on returning workers, but that's just what people here want to do. Bubala's, again, a restaurant on Commercial Street here in Provincetown, at one point was on the third generation. One of their very first HGB workers, her granddaughter, was here working. So, you know, they're committed to working with people that they trust, that they've trained, that they know well, who you know, make these kitchens run. If you've seen Commercial Street in summer, it's a miracle that anyone gets dinner, you know, and it is very, very experienced and well-trained people who help make that happen. So trying to run a restaurant with a batch of new people you found on a website is just not something most business owners here want to do.
It's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent, where you can read more about it. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Nantucket teachers are suing the town to get it to do what voters have already approved. It's an unusual lawsuit. Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current has more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Tell us about this. This is about the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act, which was approved last year by voters. What's going on here?
Yeah, so that last year we had a town meeting vote. It was a citizen petition that was sponsored by town employee Leah Hill, who requested that the town adopt the state Paid and Family and Medical Leave Act, and that program be implemented here for all town employees. Now, that was back in May of last year. So periodically throughout the year, the town employees and others have been asking for updates. The town had been in negotiations with labor unions about it, but nothing had been implemented. And this week, two public school teachers who sadly have been dealing with their own medical and health issues that would have been directly impacted by the adoption of the PSML, as it's known, filed suit against the town demanding that it implement the will of town meeting voters and, you know, adopt the act. They describe lots of things that have been, you know, that how they have personally been affected by the town not having this program available to them. And, you know, the town, for its part, has said that it has, since the town meeting vote last year, has actually been in and entered negotiations with the town's various union bargaining teams, and that multiple unions have actually declined the implementation of the act due to the imposition of the fees that are associated with PFML for their members. So that had reached a stalemate, and now we have this lawsuit by two teachers against the town, which you can read more about on our website.
Mm. Nantucket Town Meeting starts tomorrow, beginning at 8:30 in the morning at the high school. Tell us some of the issues that you're watching there. I know there's a couple of big ones.
Yeah, there are some big ones, and there's a number of big ticket spending items. Of course, short-term rentals will be back on the agenda for
again.
Yes, once again, for the sixth year in a row. You know, town meeting has already taken some actions over the past couple years with regards to short-term rentals. Voters approved a ban on corporate ownership, regulations that implemented a local registration system, but the really more troublesome, hard questions about short-term rentals have led to a stalemate for the last 5 years, whether to codify short-term rentals into the Nantucket Zoning Code. There's nothing that speaks to short-term rentals there, which has led to lawsuits and expensive litigation for the town. There's currently a case pending before the land court that may or may not decide this issue. So there's other regulations, proposed regulations that would regulate short-term rentals as an accessory use, meaning they have to be used more by the owner than they would as a short-term rental. Watching those, we're also watching there's a pivotal vote on a project to build a new nursing home for the island. Nantucket is the only municipality in the entire state of Massachusetts that has a municipally run nursing home, and a proposal to build a new 45-bed facility, which has been discussed for over a decade, is coming to a pivotal vote. The price tag has increased, you know, from, you know, originally $40 million, $50 million to $100 million, and then within the last month, the final bid came in at $126 million. So this would be the largest, most expensive municipal project the town has ever undertaken. And some late-breaking news last night, after the Finance Committee had initially endorsed the project at $100 million, it has now balked at endorsing the project at a 20% higher, $126 million. So there's going to be some wrangling tomorrow on town meeting floor, amendments, and this will ultimately come to a vote at town meeting floor and on the ballot later this month.
It's Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
This week, the Massachusetts House of Representatives passed its version of the budget for the next fiscal year. CAI's Gilda Geist spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about the budget and more. Here's their conversation.
Katie, how does this budget compare to the state's current budget?
So notably, it's bigger. It's about a 6% spending increase, since we're now at more than $61 billion. And the budget did grow throughout the debate process. The reps in the House added around $80 million in spending to bulk up that bottom line a bit more. And the budget does create some new programs that aren't funded in this year's budget. Notably, that includes a $5 million fund to help immigrants with legal assistance afford lawyers when they're charged with what lawmakers have been clear would be only nonviolent offenses. It also looks to put a pause on a plan from the Healey administration to change vocational high school admissions to a lottery system. That's another measure that's not contemplated in the current year's budget. So there are some spending and policy differences.
All right. And you report that the budget it shows a 6% spending increase. So how does the House plan to fund that increase?
Well, first of all, they don't plan to fund it with new taxes or fees on residents and businesses. So they're looking to use the money the state is already taking in. And that includes almost $2 billion in that relatively new tax on income over $1 million. The House wants to spend that as they're required to under the state constitution on education and transportation programming. So that $2 billion or so does help. There's also an assumption that the state will get around $16 billion in reimbursements from the federal government to fill out their spending.
And so how did uncertainty about the future of federal funding for Massachusetts play into this whole conversation?
That's really been the theme as they've been taking up this budget, is they're not sure how much of that federal money will ultimately materialize under Trump administration policy shifts. So lawmakers say they're trying to keep their spending plan responsible, money that the state will, they're confident the state will be able to spend this amount of money at least. But, you know, we will see down the line if they do need to make cuts as the fiscal year starts in July. And as it goes on, we might see some spending changes to this plan. They're also looking to kind of backstop areas where the federal government has already cut or telegraphed plans to cut funding, and that includes for food assistance programs. The House wants to spend more state dollars there to make up for federal changes.
And remind us, what are the next steps in the state budgeting process?
Next in May, we'll see the Senate debate and pass its own version of the budget. They usually have different priorities than the House. The two chambers will then privately negotiate the differences between their spending plans and try to get a final bill to Governor Healey by July 1st when the fiscal year starts. But they traditionally miss that deadline and keep going later into the summer.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Gilda Geist speaking with State House reporter Katie Lannon. You're listening to the Local News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Gosnold Behavioral Health, the long-standing Falmouth-based nonprofit that treats substance use disorder and other mental health issues, has made a surprising announcement. It's going to shift a big portion of its outpatient care services to another mental health provider. Devin Ankeny of the Falmouth Enterprise joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Devin.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
This is a big move, which it would appear is really downsizing Gosnold. Explain what's being proposed.
Yeah, so it's actually more than proposed. Effective July 1, 43% of Gosnold's outpatients and 10 of its clinicians are going to be moving over to NEHS. That's Northeast Health Services. They've got 31 locations all over Massachusetts.
I guess maybe give us a sense of, in numbers, how many patients that is and what happens to the staff there.
Yeah, that's going to be 560 of the outpatients. Most of those are in therapy or medication management services, and 10 of those clinicians and one administrative employee are being offered roles with Northeast Health Services.
And what is Gosnold saying about why it's making this move? It does seem from a little distance that it's something like downsizing. Is that right?
Well, it is downsizing, but I spoke with the CEO of Gosnold, and he said that this by no means should seem like Gosnold is in decline. He said that this is really just about getting that big, long wait list. They had 300 people on a wait list, making sure that they have care. By July 1, by the summer, all those 300 people that have been on a wait list for a while are going to be getting the therapy they've been looking for.
And you say that in the employees of Gosnold, who I guess, are they following their own patients along now to their new employer?
They're going to have the option. They're not going to be required, obviously, to move to a different company, but they are going to be all offered what I'm told is comparable roles at NEHS. So theoretically, Richard Kukuru told me that there should be no hiccups when it comes to patients moving over or seeing their same therapist by July 1.
And we're talking about medication management and therapy and what kinds of services? Do we know kind of what this entails, all of this?
Yeah, it's going to be mostly therapy and medication management. That's therapy is really the big one here.
How about the location? So if they're going to be served by a different supplier of services, are patients going to have to be heading to a new location? And is it farther than where they were?
Yeah, so there is a Northeast Health Services location less than a mile away from the Falmouth location that's going to be shutting down as part of their Gosnold's other move to get some of their inpatient services out of Falmouth. But it really is going to be about the same drive for most people. It's over on Gifford Street, whereas right now Gosnold's over on Terhune, and that's maybe a 5-minute drive. But most of the patients, I'm told, are actually remote, so they should have no changes other than the background that their therapist is using to provide services.
Can you talk a little bit about Northeast Health Services, the company that's taking over these cases? How are they located on the Cape, and what's the size of them? What kind of work do they provide?
Yeah, so Northeast Health Services is kind of like Gosnold, but, you know, a lot bigger. They provide a lot more therapy services. They've got about 750 employees working on this stuff rather than the 105 in outpatient care at Gosnold. They serve 80,000 clients in Massachusetts, and they've got locations in Falmouth, in Hyannis, and several near Cape, off Cape.
And what's their take on this? You spoke with them as well. They're taking on a big chunk of business here.
Yeah, so I asked them if this is going to be a difficult thing for them to take over, and they said no. They've got a lot of resources, and taking 560 patients and as many as 10 clinicians into their 80,000 clients in Massachusetts is going to be no problem.
This is all scheduled to start July 1st, right? So a lot of moving parts happening pretty quickly. Again, you kind of circling back to what's behind this for Gosnold. We know that they're already moving some of their services off Cape, and this is a big chunk of their on-Cape services that they're now kind of shuttling off to this other provider. What does that mean for them? As you spoke to Mr. Kukuru, what was the sense of what this really means for Gosnold going forward, who've been such a big part of the community here?
So he really emphasized that this is a decision that should not be taken as a trend for Gosnold. This is not something that's saying Gosnold's losing money. I asked him if any federal budgetary concerns are restricting Gosnold, and the answer right now is not really. So he can't promise anything going on in the future, but this should not be taken as a trend.
And the sense is that Gosnold is just kind of repositioning itself in a big picture way here, sending some services off Cape and sending others to NEHS, but they're going to still be in the game of substance abuse disorder treatment?
Absolutely. He said that Gosnold's been here for 53 years in Falmouth, and he's hoping to stick around for another 53. So they're closing is not on the horizon for right now.
Devin Ankeny of the Falmouth Enterprise reporting there. Devin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Eve Zuckoff, and Gilda Geist. We spoke with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. Our State House reporter, Katie Lannon, checked in, and we heard from Devin Ankeny of the Falmouth Enterprise. Big thanks to Dan Quickfingers Tritle for engineering the program. Lucky for us, he went into public broadcasting and didn't become an Old West gunslinger. You know, I can kind of picture that. That's all we've got in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.